The most common treatment for sleep apnea doesn't seem to work.
Repurposing drugs for Zika.
We're identifying lots of depression, but it's going untreated.
In defibrillator study in heart failure patients, results may not be shocking.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on September 2nd, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Of course, I started laughing right there at the study related to implantable cardiodefibrillators. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine. So go forward, sir, without being shocking.
Well, Elizabeth, this was a study that follows up on others that have shown that when people have heart failure due to coronary artery disease and they have moderately or severely depressed heart function, those individuals benefit from having a defibrillator placed in. It prevents sudden cardiac death. Well, what about in people that have heart failure not due to coronary artery disease, due to either an infection or some underlying condition? We haven't studied that very well previously, and so that's what this study attempted to do. They randomized over 1,100 patients that had heart failure, and they randomized them to receive a defibrillator or not and followed them over the course of about 5 years. What they discovered is that there was really no difference in all-cause mortality between those that received a defibrillator and those that didn't. Now, those that received the defibrillator did have a lower incidence of sudden cardiac death, but not overall death. You say, well, why wasn't it beneficial? Well, at least a third of the patients died of non-cardiac causes. And obviously, the defibrillator doesn't help there. The defibrillator doesn't help prevent progressive heart failure. All it does is prevent death from arrhythmias.
What percentage of folks with heart failure are relative to coronary artery disease versus other causes?
Somewhere between a third and a half are probably not due to coronary artery disease. Now, the other reason why the defibrillator may not be as beneficial as was thought 10 or 20 years ago is the medications we use are really much better in improving survival. And these people were on really very good medical therapy, both those who received the defibrillator and those that didn't.
Well, I guess I would finally say that we know that these ICDs are sometimes very problematic for patients. And so if there's a way to avoid placing them, sounds like a good idea to me.
About 1 in 15 or 16 patients have inappropriate shocks from them. It doesn't sense the rhythm appropriately or shocks inappropriately. As many as 1 in 20 patients will have an infection related to the device as well. So you're right, if you can avoid it, you'd like to do so.
Okay. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, let's move to the one I served up as well, the most common treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. That's CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure. A big business. Doesn't look like it's very helpful.
It depends on what you're defining as helpful. People with obstructive sleep apnea oftentimes have symptoms. They are sleepy during the day. They fall asleep during the day. They have difficulty, obviously, sleeping at night. And CPAP in the past has been shown to be useful for the symptoms. The ones that we're oftentimes concerned with are the cardiovascular events that are associated with obstructive sleep apnea. Higher incidence of heart attacks, stroke, a higher mortality as well. What this study attempted to do was to address whether CPAP is beneficial for A, relieving symptoms, and more importantly, in preventing the cardiovascular events. They enrolled over 2,700 adults between the ages of 45 and 75 who had moderate to severe sleep apnea, and they were already known to have heart disease or had a previous stroke. They were randomized to receive CPAP, half the individuals, and the other half not. Interestingly enough, those that were randomized to CPAP on average only had about 3 1/3 hours of its use throughout the evening. But at the end of the follow-up, which occurred over 3.7 years, there was no difference in terms of cardiovascular events between those that were treated with CPAP and those that weren't.
Right. And so when you were honing in on the definition of helpfulness, certainly the symptoms then were relieved by the use of this device, but not the hard endpoints. As I suggested, this is big business. As we're aware, my goodness, Medicare et al. Are paying a lot of money for CPAP. And if it's not really going to have that kind of an impact, I have to question whether or not it's worth paying all that money for it.
Well, you can certainly make that case for people that have mild symptoms because CPAP isn't preventing cardiovascular events in those individuals. But people that have severe symptoms, I think the recommendation still holds true to treat those individuals with CPAP. The other thing that's a little disconcerting is these individuals wore it for an average of a little over 3 hours. Would you have a different outcome if they had used it for 6 or 7 or 8 hours? This is a real world study though. And so even individuals that are given CPAP, many times those individuals won't wear it all evening. The real world use of CPAP wasn't particularly beneficial.
I think the other thing that's kind of intellectually curious to me about this study is it seems to question or else raise some issues relative to, well, what is the relationship between sleep apnea and cardiovascular events?
The studies have clearly shown that there is an association between the two. Is it the obstructive sleep apnea that's causing the cardiovascular events, or is there some other underlying issue and this is just an association?
That's what I'm interested in. I mean, is it a hypoxia mechanism or what is the mechanism where it's related?
If it is hypoxia, what you'd like to do is make sure that the CPAP is worn during periods of REM sleep. And those oftentimes occur later in the sleep pattern, not the first 3 hours, but in the last 3 or 4 hours. You know, I think this doesn't close the door on CPAP. It means we need to be smarter about how we use it.
Okay, let's turn from here to JAMA Internal Medicine. This is a little disconcerting. We're doing all this screening for depression, trying to identify people. We know we have a huge public health issue with regard to suicide, especially among middle-aged white men. Yet when we find depression, it goes untreated.
So when you picked this study, I almost started to yawn, Elizabeth, like what more could we learn about depression that we don't already know? And we've talked about it multiple times over the last decade, but I'm glad you picked this because it certainly brought things to mind that I was unaware of. So let's take a step back and say, what did they do? They looked at household surveys to find out what the incidence of depression was, whether it was mild, moderate, or severe, and then whether the people were being treated appropriately for that depression. And what they discovered in looking at over 46,000 responses, that the incidence of depression was about 8.5%. Unfortunately, only about a fourth of those patients received any type of depression treatment. Conversely, for all adults that were being treated for depression, only about one-third had screened positive depression, and about one-fifth had serious psychological distress. This suggests there are many people that are already on medications in which we don't have a clear indication. So the people that need them oftentimes aren't getting them. We've seen this big flurry of increased prescribing of antidepressant drugs, but oftentimes they don't seem to be matching the patients. So this survey, I think, showed problems at both ends of the spectrum.
It's stymieing to me to try to speculate on a way to address these issues.
We know that in people with moderate depression or severe depression, the use of psychotherapy can oftentimes replace medications and or supplement medications. And as a result of the fact that we're now screening patients in primary care settings, and oftentimes the primary care physician isn't up to date with the most effective therapies or which patients needed to be treated or followed accurately, we're not matching the therapy with the severity of the disease.
Sounds like yet one more thing that these primary care docs are going to need to do.
Yep.
Finally, then, let's turn to Nature Medicine. A study that originated here at Johns Hopkins, screening existing drugs, utilizing a really innovative model for doing so for Zika.
If you start from scratch with a new medication that's formulated, for example, you take it through phase 1 trials to show it's not toxic to individuals, maybe phase 2 trials to show it's somewhat effective, then to larger stage 3 trials, those studies can take years. What would be nice is to take drugs that are already on the market and to see if they can be repurposed for whatever the new disease or condition we're applying for. So what these investigators did was they looked at a panel of over 6,000 known drugs to see whether they could have properties that might be useful with Zika, either preventing death of brain cells that are infected with the Zika virus or preventing either entry of Zika virus into the brain cells or its replication once it's there. We know now that when mothers are affected with Zika, the Zika infection preferentially affects the brain of the fetus. Using this screening, they were able to identify at least 2 drugs that help prevent some of this cell death. Once the Zika is infecting the brain cell, at least in culture, it prevents death of those particular brain cells. They also identified 9 or 10 other drugs that prevent replication of the Zika virus once it gets into the brain cell. So in the laboratory, we have at least 12 medications that have been repurposed. We know that they're not toxic to humans. So the question is, in animal studies, will they prove to be as fruitful as they are in the lab?
I think one of the things I find persuasive about this study is that this is not just a simple tissue culture. This is actually a whole kind of mini organ that they've developed in order to assess this. And gosh, we're seeing that in lots of different areas of medicine right now.
And because the Zika virus affects development of the brain, and they're calling it an organoid, that is a kind of a primitive brain structure, to show that the medications can interfere with the Zika involvement with the organoid. And so you're right. I'm going to call it a very sexy study. This can be done relatively quickly. And so it's an opportunity to move it from the lab to the bedside a lot faster.
Lots of slips between here and there, but at least this is a positive development, I think, in this whole Zika crisis.
And as you identified, it's less about these particular medications and more about the process and how this can be applied to other conditions as well.
Excellent. Well, that's the one I'm going to highlight on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.